Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Okay, does the sound okay on that?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Rachel, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Rachel.
And thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. You can feel the waves of enthusiasm rolling off of this group, and you can hear the level of commitment and service just in the announcements going on, the number of people raising their hands as home group members, and it's powerful sitting here thinking about the way that rubs off. I'm a big believer in spiritual momentum, just as I am spiritual inertia, and I guess it kind of goes back to stick with the winners kind of thing. If I'm not in a space where I have a lot of spiritual momentum going on, if I'm around people who do, chances are I'm going to start rolling, and I get to keep moving in that. So I thank you for all of you for your service and being here and various different roles that you serve. My heart still pounds every time I get up here, and I've kind of learned like that's okay and it's probably never going to go away. Some of you might have seen me over there on the swings. I was praying, I was talking to God, but even still, my heart's like, it seems like you guys might be able to see it beating. And, I've gotten to okay with that, to realizing that that the steps give me a relationship with someone bigger, with something bigger, a relationship with myself and a relationship with you guys. They don't take away my humanity, and thank goodness. There was a time, and I imagine I'll get into this some in my story, but there was a time when I thought, you know, the steps were going to make me God. That's not what I told you guys, but that was the plan. And I did everything I could to be the best AA. And when I had, when I had those human feelings as we have all the time, I thought maybe I had not done the steps right. And I know today the reality is that the steps give me an opportunity when stuff comes up to just be real about it. You know, to go whisper to the power of my understanding, and get honest about the fact that my heart's beating because I'm afraid of what you guys might think of me. Right? That's what happens when we get up here. I was just talking to somebody just before we started who's new and saying, boy, this is tough being around a lot of people. And I said, welcome. Like, that is, I just remember walking into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was bad enough being around myself. And then suddenly I was thrown into room after room of a lot of people who I was convinced, the inner monologue for me was that you guys all knew exactly what a fraud I was. And you were looking at what I was wearing, which obviously wasn't good enough, and I wasn't smart enough and pretty enough and all that. So like, that was the constant monologue, and you wanted me to come into a room of you and talk, and that was pretty terrifying. You know, all that stuff was going on, but I had no idea that was what my problem was. I share about, I mean, for me, my story was that I went to rehab, where a clinician there that I really trusted said go to AA, and I did because I wanted to get back. I hadn't lost a lot of the things that I'd heard you guys lose, which for that reason I thought I probably wasn't an alcoholic. I wanted to get the stuff back that I did lose. I had dropped out of college before my grades got bad enough that they could kick me out, and I was drinking, getting high, all by myself, right? There were no friends to speak of. My parents didn't know who I was anymore. I was a very different person, you know? And I wanted to get just that kind of stuff back, and my clinician, who I trusted at rehab, said to head to AA, and I was willing to do that. And I thought for sure the problem was that I was drinking and getting high, and as soon as I stopped doing those things, then all would be well. Which, when I look at it now, is pretty ironic, because all was never well. I was suicidal from as young as I can remember, and alcohol took the edge off of that. Right? I hear people say alcohol was my solution, not my problem, and that was absolutely so true for me. And without a shadow of a doubt, guys, if alcohol was still working, I wouldn't be up here, because it's a quick fix. It takes that pain, that anxiety, that constant dialogue of, like, you guys are looking at what I'm wearing and what I'm saying, and takes that away like that, right? And the steps take that stuff away too and replace it with something pretty magical, but it's not like that. And I don't know about you, but I'm more of the quick fix variety. So thank God alcohol stopped working. And for me, I would hear people say that they were grateful, recovering alcoholics, or they were so grateful to be in AA. And I remember being new and thinking, what are they talking about? Because I came in here knowing, you know, my perception, knowing that what I was a screw up. And I had embarrassed myself and certainly shamed my family, and I should have known better. And I couldn't even find an excuse. Like, I couldn't find some major traumatic event in my childhood to blame it on. Some of you guys at least had that. I couldn't figure out, like, what was I doing here? And I beyond relate today to those people I would hear say that becoming aware of being an alcoholic was the single greatest thing that ever happened to them. I know that that's true for me today, because when I look back on the reality of who I was, even when alcohol entered, you know, young enough, I was somebody who couldn't sit in my own skin. And so to find a fellowship and a program and a solution that allows me to do that and allows me, the really basic things that I do today, like, you know, I want to say go to work on a daily basis, but the reality is, like, I grew up in a family where that stuff happened. I think if I didn't go to work on a daily basis, like, I don't know what I would think of myself. It's just I grew up in a family like that. But I've challenged myself to be in a job that pushes my comfort zone every single day. I've gone in and asked for raises. Like, I have done things that speak to the fact that I know who I am and what I'm worth today. And you can sure know that when I walked into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I wasn't worth a thing. And I thought all you guys could see right through that. And alcohol was simply the thing that made that better. And, you know, thank God for me, drugs entered my story a couple years before I came in here, and they were really the predominant piece of my story for the last 2 years before I walked in here. And thank goodness, because I think I arrived at least 10 years before I would have otherwise. And so glad that I was able to go downhill in the way that I did as quickly as I did with that. And so I'll give some background. I already shared a little bit here that, I guess I should share I always forget my sobriety date. I think it's October 6, 2007. I'm coming up on 8 years. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I got a sponsor early on in this program, and there was a time that I didn't have a sponsor, or I had a sponsor in name, like, did she know she was sponsoring me kind of thing. And that time was 3 years. So that was painful. And I'm really glad I have a sponsor today. And I have had incredible women be willing to walk me through simply what they were walked through and teach me that it wasn't that they had the answers, but that they were able to humble themselves enough to know that they didn't, so they could simply be with me and guide me to the answers within myself. So I grew up in what I look at as an upper middle class family, and I know a lot more today about how I was affected when I was younger than I did when I walked in here. Like I said, when I walked in here, I was like looking for something really traumatic, because I needed to blame my alcoholism on something. I was so ashamed, and I knew that I had just screwed up. It was that simple. I was like, surprise, alcoholism. There was nobody else in my family that was drinking. I picked up the phone and was said, can I need to go to rehab, to my parents. And that, I think their experience with that was, oh, like everything fell into place there for them. But I was really the first in my family in many generations. And I grew up in a pretty normal home. There was enough chaos now when I look back on it, but my father drank like a normal person, and my mother didn't drink. And she had, I think she had gotten drunk once, and she said, like, ugh. Which, if I think about it now, a lot of the years I spent resisting against my mom and fighting against her had a lot to do with the fact that I thought she didn't know what life was about. Because I could not imagine somebody thinking about interacting with other people or hanging out or doing, like, what was she even doing? She just didn't get life. And that was really my perspective. And that reminds me, you know, the book talks about this is our only normal, this is our only reality. This is what's normal for us. And so to me, it was so abnormal that she just didn't like that feeling that I couldn't relate to her until, you know, coming into sobriety. It is amazing. We talk about the gifts, the promises. My mother and I could not be we literally could not be together for more than 5 minutes without screaming, crying, you know, I'm done for good kind of thing. And always the remorse and shame after that, right? Because I didn't want to be a bad daughter. And this was like drinking or not. And today the relationship I have with my mom is, it blows me away. And I'm starting to be able to get to know her for who she is, because I came in here with a lot of resentments about everybody, because I wanted them to be the person I needed them to be for me. And my mom was high on that list because I wanted her to love me the way that I thought she needed to, so that I could, again, like, feel okay about myself. And it's really, the reality is, it's only been in the last couple years that I've started to see who my mom is for her. That she doesn't necessarily connect the way I do. And, like, that's okay. I can meet her where she can meet me then. And that's, the gifts of that have been incredibly, incredibly rewarding. So growing up in this home, alcohol was not a big deal either way. I was so inside my skin long before I ever knew what that meant. When I came in here, here's what I'll say, speaking back to my clinician said to come to AA, I thought, well, here, I had a litany of reasons why I wasn't an alcoholic, right? I was too young. I got sober in a place where there weren't a lot of young people. I was too young. I got caught up in drugs. If any of you guys were sniffing oxys, it'd be a problem too. Like, you know, I hadn't gotten arrested. Well, there was that one time, but not such a big deal. And, right? Yeah. Like, I hadn't lost a lot of stuff. And the reality was, is I was the kind, they talk about the kind of alcoholics. I was the functional one. People really, for the most part, people didn't know what was going on in my life, except that I had receded so far inside of myself, or I was the angriest, meanest person you could see, you know, depending on the day and how alcohol was taking me that day. I lost where I was going. But I know I walked in here thinking that I didn't necessarily belong, and I was here because I wanted to get my stuff back, and I came from a family where you create a plan and you follow the plan and then you succeed, and that's that. And I had fallen off the plan and I was going to get back on track. And I heard you guys talking about a lot of, like, alcohol's a symptom, and I'm the root of my troubles and selfishness and self-centeredness. And I'm thinking, I don't know what you guys are talking about. Like, I brought candy to rehab for my friends there. You know, I couldn't see that the selfishness was a lot more than, like, robbing, cheating, stealing, lying. Because my alcoholism hadn't taken me to that level. Whether it ever would have, I don't know. I mean, I think we all eventually will go there, and some of us go there quicker than others. But I think my fear of breaking the rules, it was just who I am, the way I was raised, my fear of breaking the rules had my selfishness more leaning towards the generous and kind, you know, the kind where, like, you're so pretty, and what are you going to give back to me now that you know, like, I brought you candy at rehab, right? Like, I could not see that all I was doing was distracting myself from me and trying to set it up so that everybody was going to like me. So I heard you guys talking about that, couldn't relate, you know, later down the line, obviously, here I am, I learned how to relate to that stuff, but I remember thinking, you have a lot of work to do, people, and really thinking that, and there was somewhere around, I think it was only like 3 months, and you know, everybody's journey is different, I think it was around 3 months, and there had been a woman who was taking me to meetings all the time, and just showing me around and showing me the ropes of AA. And I walked out of a meeting one day, and I don't remember what had been said that day, but I walked out and I said, oh my God, I think I might have a lot of work to do too. Something had clicked that day. Somebody was sharing honestly and openly enough about this selfishness, about the fact, I love it. I had a roommate who would always say, this selfishness is not this, like, if there's two brownies and you have, like, one center chewy delicious brownie and, like, a corner crunchy crusty brownie and you take the center one. Like, it's not that kind of selfishness. It's the kind of selfishness that I don't feel all right about myself, and I will do anything it takes to make myself feel okay. And I don't care who I hurt or who I manipulate or who I leave in the dust or what role I have to play. And alcohol allowed me to play a lot of different roles. And I heard something that day that it suddenly clicked that this selfishness was not about taking the center brownie. I wasn't out there robbing people, but I sure as hell wasn't thinking at all about how it was affecting anybody else. I wanted for me to get whatever I needed in any given minute. And that there started my journey with the steps. And I remember sitting down. I had a sponsor at the time, and she was having me take it slow. I think I had pulled out of college, and the program that I was in, I needed to take a full year off because the way the courses were set up. And the sponsor I had at the time was saying, like, I think you need to kind of wait until things settle down, you get back in school, and things are more comfortable so that you can really get into some of this. You don't want to kind of unsettle yourself before everything else is kind of in place. And I trusted her because I didn't know any different. And I also couldn't deny the fact that I was still suicidal. I no longer had alcohol, and now I was simply acting like my parents had taken me back into their home after I had gotten sober. And they were kind enough to do this, despite the fact that I had been using money that they were giving me for school and using it for my habits, and despite the fact that I had been lying for however long and they had given me this chance, and I'm living in their home, and that selfishness is coming out. Like, just as simply as, like, Mom, I can't believe there's stuff in the dryer. Like, you know, I'm 22 years old, and I'm acting like, well, I don't know, maybe there's a lot of 22-year-olds that act that way these days. But I can tell you, when I look at it now and I think about the position that I put them in and the way that they offered their generosity back over to me, I just couldn't, I could not see outside of myself, you know? And you guys, you know, booze was gone, and for me it was like men was another quick fix, so I just chased men around the state at different meetings, you know, show up at an 8 a.m. meeting with a guy on my arm, like, we're just friends. Like, you guys didn't know. We all come in here and we're trying to fill that space in us with something else. And like, I am so grateful for those strong personalities in AA who showed me what it was like to walk in dignity, showed me how to get women's numbers and stick with ladies, and just walked in the truth for that. So I got to see what that looked like. Because, like, I go to women's meetings today and I love them, and that took me something like 6 years to get comfortable with, and now I adore them. But really, if you asked me to go to a women's meeting when I walked in here, I thought, what is in it for me? Because that's what I was looking for with everything out of life. You know, and alcohol, there was a lot in it for me. I got to take myself out of that discomfort and be whoever I needed to be in that moment. And with women, it was like women were going to be a mirror to who I was. They weren't going to validate me for something superficial. And that was really scary. And I'm also grateful for people who just allowed me to have my journey, right? It took me 6 years. I had a lot of sponsors in that time, and they let me get there when I needed to get there. And that's something I've learned to do with my own sponsees too, is to allow their higher power to really guide their journeys and not me. And I've learned to do that. Everything I've learned, guys, has come from lots of mistakes. Right? All I have to give you today is simply because of mistakes that I've made many times over. And thank goodness we all have our mistakes. It's why we're late. I'm a big believer. I've started to get into a woman named Brené Brown. I don't know if anybody knows of her, but she's a researcher on shame. And I'm listening to her stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, she's in the mind of the alcoholic, like this constant obsession of what about me, and I'm not good enough. And it just, like, the tape won't stop, and there's nothing that I can do to get in the way of it except numb out with something. And she said something that struck me so hard, and I thought, yes, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. She said, shame cannot live in the presence of me too. And boy, is that not the power. What the Big Book talks about is that we can sit down with therapists and doctors and family members and lie about our alcoholism over and over again and get defensive. But we sit down for a few minutes with another alcoholic and our walls start to crumble. The power of the fifth step, where those things that I've carried with me from very young that I am sure that if anyone knew, they would walk. They would walk. And they say, me too? And my alcoholism can't live and breathe in that. And that, you know, that is what this fellowship does for me. So when I got in enough pain there, which was, like I said, short enough time, because I was showing up and I was acting out. I was hearing about what sobriety was, but I certainly wasn't feeling sober, whatever that was supposed to be. You know, I wasn't drinking, but I was sleeping around and I was throwing temper tantrums at home, and I couldn't sit in my own skin, and I didn't know how to look you guys in the eye. And I sat down with another woman who was a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I kind of want to do these steps that I'm hearing about, but I'm not sure, and I'm getting some guidance maybe to hold off until other parts of my life are more stable. And she, I still think of it as one of the single greatest gifts that somebody handed me, is she looked me in the eyes and she said, if you don't have new tools, why do you think that you should be able to have new behaviors, to make new decisions? Because I came in here and I heard you guys telling me what sobriety looked like, and I couldn't live up to it. The same way I couldn't stop drinking every time I tried, right? And that's when I started to learn it's all the same deal. Is I am as powerless over my selfish thinking and my selfish behavior as I was my alcoholism, as I was the alcohol itself. You know, and I'll just step back and say, because it's so important to focus on like what really makes us alcoholics. Because I walked in here ready to leave once I got my stuff back, ready to leave because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I told you all the reasons that I wasn't an alcoholic, but it wasn't until I then sat down with this woman who had stared at me in the car and said, new tools, new life, right? It wasn't until she started walking me through these steps that I learned that my idea of an alcoholic had resembled very little what's going on in our big book. Right, and what you guys teach me is an alcoholic. In fact, it had no resemblance. You know, I was convinced that what we hear people say, right, drinking out of brown bag under a bridge. Bottom line is, a lot of us come in here thinking like, if it gets really bad, then I'm an alcoholic. If I have to drink every second of every day, then I'm an alcoholic. And my story didn't look like that. And it was confused by the fact that I had gotten really tangled up in drugs, and I really couldn't separate like what was alcoholism, what was that, and it was really, it's amazing how direct this program is and really clear, because she was able to ask me just a couple questions. Like, if I set out to have one, was I successful? And the truth was, for me, my story was sometimes. Like, sometimes I could set out to have the amount that I intended to have. It was still usually painful. You know, I don't think people I don't think people outside of these rooms have that experience where it's all that painful to stop at whatever number they decide to stop. You know, it's like that feeling you have when somebody says, like, I have a six pack, and you're like, well, why bother? Because the pain of having that is a hell of a lot greater than just holding off altogether. And so she asked, do you decide when you stop? And I didn't decide when I stopped every time. Sometimes I could, but she pointed out that, you know, the book talks about that. The people who don't have this issue, they never experience that. And I grew up in a family where it wasn't a problem. And I remember many times seeing my dad pour himself a scotch, drink some of it, pour the rest down the drain, and go to bed. And for any of you that makes you feel like violently ill, that's when you know you may have had experience with the allergy, right? And that's when I started to learn what the allergy was, which I had no idea. And I read the doctor's opinion with my sponsor and was so excited by it. I connected to it. I mean, I connect to it today in a different way. Sometimes I want to just feel that same excitement. We can never quite get that experience back, except with what, like working with other people. And then suddenly we have it, and that power just flows through us, and we feel that enthusiasm. But I remember reading the doctor's opinion and thinking, like, this is why. It's not because I'm a crappy daughter, and because I don't care about anybody around me, and I'm trying to flush my future down the drain, and I'm just a bad person, and I hate you. You know, like, all the things I came in here, like, totally ashamed about what went wrong, I screwed up. And here she was telling me, you react differently. It's not a lack of willpower. It's not a lack of you know, being a decent human being that you can't pour half a scotch down the drain. And I remember reading that doctor's opinion and being so excited. And I brought it home to my father to read it. And because I just thought, this is me. Like, you have to see this. And my father, he's a research scientist. And he read the doctor's opinion, and he's, I'm sure I always exaggerate now as to what it looked like, but in my mind, this is what it was. He's like, and what is the current opinion on the subject of alcoholism? You know, he's like, he wants some hard facts. And that's the difference between an alcoholic hearing about the allergy and a non-alcoholic hearing about the allergy, right? If I've had the allergy and you tell me, here's a description of what you've felt, and you've experienced, I'm like, oh, there's a name for it. You tell somebody that doesn't have the allergy about this, it is bogus. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, which is a beautiful thing, because what I got to see is that as I started to relate to the steps and I started to relate to what this program had to offer, I could really clearly identify as an alcoholic. And that was what I was going to need to do to be willing to go all in. Because you guys, the reality is you guys ask a lot of me. Right? Bill says simple, not easy. And the different years and different months and different days have different asks, but it's always, really, this is not my nature, is to come up here and think about other people, put myself out there, not numb out for every experience I'm in. That's not my nature. Let alone going out and making amends and things like this and working with other people. So you guys ask a lot, and everything is so totally worth it. And I always think, like, the idea of the allergy is, to me, it's the simpler piece of step one, right? If I drink, I'm going to get drunk. But the piece that's like, what? is the second part, is that I cannot trust my mind to remember that or to follow through with it, right? And I always use the example because it's so clear to me. It's not a coincidence that they use the word allergy in the book. It's easy for us to identify with that if some of us have poison and IV allergies or something like that. We can identify with the fact that you're not going to talk yourself out of itching. You're not going to pep talk yourself out of that. And that's the kind of thing, like, I'd wake up and say, you're not drinking today. And there I was drinking. And then I'd say, but you're not having more than whatever. And there I was past that. Because we're talking about an allergy, something I can't control. And the example that I use is that I have an allergy. I get severe migraines from cigarette smoke. So you will never see me go full force, hug somebody who's smoking a cigarette. If I'm walking through the gauntlet before a meeting, like, I'm typically not breathing, so I won't stop and say hi. And I never have the thought, I have never in my life had the thought to try, like, really inhaling in that gauntlet. Like, maybe this time I'm not going to get a migraine. Or, like, can I just bum a cigarette tonight? I have never had the thought that I would like to enjoy a migraine tonight. And yet, I seem to have the thought a hell of a lot when it came to alcohol, that I would like to shame and embarrass myself and sleep with somebody who I don't know who they are the next day and ruin whatever friendship. And I'd like to miss class and I'd like to not show up for work. You know, this was, if I was making a conscious choice, that might have been what it looked like if I was saying it that way. But it was never a conscious choice. It was, I'll deal with it later. Right? Like, I guess what I should say is, and step one talks about this, is that we might think it's a conscious choice. We might say, like, no, I've thought through what's going on. But if we actually had the power and choice, would I really say I would like to throw this doctorate degree down the drain? What? I worked like 4 years towards this degree before I then dropped out because my alcoholism had taken over to such a great degree. And it's like the physical part of this, when I start, I can't stop, I could see that better, but I couldn't understand because I could function in a hell of a lot of ways in other areas of my life until towards the end when there was not much functioning happening, period. But I could hold down a job and make friends and impress people around me and whatever. I was that functional person. And so you guys told me that I couldn't actually trust that part of me to not drink. And it didn't make much sense except that you know, it's funny when we sit down with somebody and they start to ask us, like, do we identify with this? Maybe tell me some stories about this, or can you relate in some way? It's funny how we don't quite remember that stuff right away. And we'll need a sponsor or somebody to say, but what about when, and didn't that, and how about, and that's when that step one was sinking in. So, you know, step one, absolutely vital, right? But won't save my butt. Not going to keep me from drinking. I had to come to terms with that. I had to identify. If I had stayed in here and said, well, I was too young and I got caught up in drugs and I didn't really have the same consequences as you guys and I can function in a lot of other ways, and I hadn't identified with step one, I don't know how long I would have lasted, but eventually I would have gone. Because here's the deal. I got to give credit to willpower. Willpower really works, right? Until it doesn't. And then since I have an allergy, that's a bit of a problem. You know, because I was somebody who came in here and I was challenging everything that you guys told me, like, come on, what's this? I don't think I thought of you guys as a cult, but I was challenging everything anybody ever told me. So So when I was thinking, like, willpower worked. It did work sometimes, you know. And I was 3 months sober and miserable in here, so willpower was working. But eventually it was going to give way. And that's really like the power of step one for me is understanding that I need to get it in order to say, okay, I'll take the other 11. Because getting it is still never going to work for me. Because it's amazing. I've been sober, what did I say, 7.5 years. And wouldn't you think then that would mean that for all of the time since when I found the steps and started to have this amazing spiritual experience that I had never for a second doubted AA? Wouldn't you think that? Because that would be logical, right? But that's not the way that second part of step one works, the mental obsession. You know, my experience is that my obsession to drink alcohol in sobriety has very, very rarely come in the form of any statement that says, have some alcohol. It comes in the form of, I cannot hear that person share the same thing again. Or, she doesn't want to hear me call about this. This has been too long that I've been dealing with this. Or, I'm in too much service. Really need some, just need to cut this back. Or, you know, that's, And that's testament to the power of alcoholism, right? Because the book says we have huge emotional rearrangements and displacements, and I've had experience with that. So you would think I would have never, ever wavered from the program of AA. Yeah, right. Not even close to true. You know, and thank God, again, for that spiritual momentum of other people and the enthusiasm that I get to tap back into, and that I've also been willing, in those moments when I am so on board with Alcoholics Anonymous, to create a fellowship around me of people who hold me accountable. You know, to put myself in service in such a way that even if I wanted to leave, I'm sponsoring so many girls that, like, yeah, right, I can't. Like, not going to happen. So that's the power to me of the way that alcoholism works in terms of wanting to bring me back out. And I was thinking a little bit today about, I don't know why, I was thinking a little bit about steps two and three, and that my experience with them initially was, you know, once I admitted, okay, I'm not going to control this thing on my own. I had tried for years. I'd done the, like, throw everything away in the morning and by 6 p.m. trying to figure out who I need to call or, like, what's still open or, you know, do I need to cross state lines? And I had done that many times. So when I knew I wasn't going to beat this thing on my own, or when I was willing to admit that that was the truth and ready to take on the next 11, my step two, I said, let's skip this thing, because I had done lots of religion. I grew up Jewish, and I had done all the different religious certifications, and I had Sunday school and Hebrew school and bat mitzvah and confirmed, and I don't know what else. And we were, I don't know, maybe we were a culturally religious household. We certainly weren't a household of faith, but I said, let's skip this step, and my sponsor said, let's not skip this step. And so we didn't. And thank goodness, right? Because what I thought that step two meant, which, you know, coming to believe that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity, I thought that it meant that when you guys said the word God, I wasn't the person that walked out of here because I was pissed about that. That's what I thought step two meant. Like, thank goodness for sponsors, right? That there was a little more clarity about what was held within that framework. And I had no idea the walls that I had put up around a power bigger than me. And I love that we agnostics, that chapter, I just call it the yeah, but chapter. Like, you have an excuse for why an HP is impossible in your life? Okay, we'll check this next paragraph. And it's like, just seemed, it was as true for me when I went through it with my sponsor as it is today when I go through it with girls, that whatever it is they're like, yeah, butting about, oh, okay, that's on the next page. We'll talk about that in a second. And I think the book can never speak to it more eloquently. Or I could never speak to it as eloquently as the book does. And I had no idea how many walls I had built up around this. And I realized today that a lot of my walls were a lot of it was like, I didn't want to look stupid for believing in something bigger. I had this aunt. I mean, it's true. I had this aunt who was this evangelical Christian, and she would go around the, and I, Jewish family, so she had married in. And so that was already not going to fare well for her. But she, if any of you are Jewish, you really know what I mean. So she goes around the world bringing her message of faith and hope to people, and she was considered the quack of the family. And she's, okay, now that I'm, like, more sober, she's a little, like, still a little loopy. But the reality was is that this woman had and has an incredible faith that she carries around the world. And she was the outcast for that. That wasn't logical. I grew up in a house of logic. If you can't see, feel, touch, smell, it doesn't exist. And there was a lot of fear around being that idiot that looked like there was something bigger, like relying on something bigger. Get it together, Rachel. And I started to see the way that played out. I usually share this because it's funny to me. My aunt would send out cards on every occasion, birthday, whatever you can think of. And they were always homemade, printed out, and they'd have a little Bible verse in them. And I'd get them, and I would never think about the fact that this woman was reaching out time after time, inviting me out to visit with her, that she had raised 5 children with a husband who had passed early, and three of the children had chronic illnesses, and that she was a woman of strength and character, as the book talks about. Like, we failed to see where other people might be gaining some strength from their relationship with their higher power. And I would tear open the envelope and, you know, immediately go straight up, oh, Bible verse, okay. And this was what I could see. And I had no idea that when I said skip step 2, I had all this stuff standing in the way between me and something bigger. And I was okay getting on my knees and praying about sobriety. I didn't mind that. But when you guys said that things like, I was terrified about getting back into school. I didn't know how I was going to do that. I had been drunk and high for the 2 years previous. I had no idea what I learned or who knew or... And you guys suggested, like, well, let's hand that one over too. You were crazy. I had to, like, this is how I thought. I have to write up index cards so I can study to get back on track. And does God know how to write up index cards? Like, that's where I take it, right? So I'd say, this part of my life I can invite something bigger in, and this part not so much. And it was pointed out that the step asked me if I'm willing to believe in something greater than myself, right? And if it's greater than myself, how can I possibly be deciding what falls into that realm or not? That's a power smaller than me. And that was what I had. I mean, I hadn't been relying on anything previously, right? We talk about alcohol being our higher power, and certainly I was a slave to that as much as I was a slave to your validation and a lot of other things. But I certainly never put my faith in trusting that things could fundamentally be okay, including having to write out a bunch of index cards and study them. So my absolute faith, the book talks about we have resolute faith in certain things that aren't panning out. My resolute faith was in, like, my constant anxiety and worry. If I worry about this enough, then somehow I'll be okay when I get back into school. And that didn't work ever, and I trusted that implicitly. So I was kind of asked to just point that faith in a different direction. But I was thinking about step 2 and 3 today in thinking that it is just such a, step 2 and 3 are constant in my life, at least, I think in most of our lives. Every single day I am asked if I'll put this thing in the realm of my higher power or that thing. You know, the ones that I have call marks in and the ones that my sponsor keeps hearing me talk about, the yeah, but ones. And you know, at the time my sponsor walked me through breaking down some of these walls that I built up that I didn't know I had, and I think about today how different it is, but yet how blind I can still be, because I have all those yeah but stories why I can't, right? My husband and I ended up bringing in a, she's almost 17 now. We've had her in our home for about a year and a half. I definitely call my sponsor on this one, right? Like, but what do I say? You wouldn't believe what she's doing and how this thing's playing out and the boyfriend, and she's not going to be okay with the boyfriend because this, that, and the other thing's going to happen. And I get to, you know what she asked me? Were you being agnostic in this? Right? When I really think about what does step 2 look like today for me, it's those things I have claw marks in that I say are still separate. So I realize that every day, every year, every month, like, the list grows of what I see as the umbrella of my higher power, right? Because when I started, it was sobriety. And then, okay, maybe I'll put school in there. And then eventually, I remember I was sponsoring for a long time without my higher power, and that was ugly. And I put that in there, you know. But it starts to expand, and in the same way, I mean, it's really the same list that then goes on my 6th step, right? It's the same list that goes on my ongoing 6th step, and I think the more we grow in our sobriety, the more we realize how many spaces and places we're agnostic in, and how much room we have to grow our faith and our relationship in a power greater than ourselves, which I've come to believe firmly is simply growing our relationship with ourselves, right? And I love the line in the book that says that we have that feeling for a higher power deep down within. It's as real as, as real as the feeling we have for a friend. And my faith has gotten to grow so immensely and strangely and uncomfortably throughout this time. I was raised Jewish, and as I mentioned, and certainly in my family, and I think it's true of a lot of people in that culture, that there's really a lot of encouragement to stay within Judaism, and to keep that focus. And you guys told me that I could have anything that tickled my heart, right? Anything that resonated for me could be the power of my understanding. And again, like, this is, I'm at a space where, this happens when we look back on things, right? I'm at a space where I'm so comfortable with how long it took me to get comfortable with my relationship with my higher power, right? There are things today I'm terribly uncomfortable with that I'm sure in a couple years I'll be standing very comfortable with how my journey progressed. And I think it's just something that time allows us the wisdom to see that our higher powers are simply working in all this stuff anyway. But I've had the strangest journey with Sharon recently, because I was sharing on step 11, but it's like I tried to find my faith within the Jewish religion, and then I was like seeking out Bible-based churches where they're singing and dancing and playing the guitar, and then, you know, you get in my car and all I'm playing is Christian rock, and my parents are like, "Are you following Jesus now?" And I just had this journey, and today I have this faith that is I have this friend who said this quote that I love. She says, "I have a deep and unwavering faith that comes and goes." Right. And I love the laughter, right? Because the laughter means me too. And it's true. But I have a deep and unwavering faith, and it sure as heck comes and goes. And it is absolutely my faith. And it's amazing. I've watched my family grow as I've grown in this. You know, their own constraints, their own fears about who I needed to be. And they've watched sobriety grow me into somebody who knows simply who I am. And it really has given them the freedom to do the same. I had this incredible experience. I got married in October, and my father and I, we danced the daddy-daughter dance, and he leaned in as the music was playing, and he said, "Rachel, you've changed me so much." And I think about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, because absolutely not, I have not had the power to make a shift in him. But the glow that he started to see in my eyes, the way that he sees how you have encouraged me and supported me to dedicate my life to other people, regardless of what I think I need, and I trust, and then things that I need do come. They come, right? And the way he's seen me step outside of my skin and have the confidence to pursue a career, and the way, I mean, things like this, I followed my father's path in terms of being somebody who couldn't look you guys in the eye, right? And he sings in two choruses now. And that's not me, right? That's the power of something bigger coming through you guys and allowing me to simply show up, and other people can see, like, this is the glory of who we can be. And, you know, the third step, hand in hand, when I took the third step the first time, I didn't know what it meant or what I was doing, but I knew that I wanted to not feel badly anymore. And I knew that we had just done step two, and step three followed that. And so I kneeled and took the third step. And I kind of think of it like in Judaism, your bat mitzvah is it's like you're coming of age. You are an adult now at whatever it is, 12 and a half for a girl. And you are professing to your God that, you know, you're in service now, right? And then later on, years from there, confirmation is when you now, having really knowledge and experience with that faith, you are reconfirming that. And I so much relate my experience in this program in that way, that I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Thank goodness. Like, would any of us stay? But I knew that it hurt really bad, and you guys said it wouldn't hurt if I kept putting one foot in front of the other. And by the way, I didn't believe you, and I certainly didn't believe my sponsor, and I asked her a trillion questions, and she said, "Do now, understand later." And it's the same for me today. You know, I ask fewer questions because there's more trust, but it's the same, and I get to pass that advice along because it's no one can convince me that this stuff works. I have to have my own experience. And I have to re-experience it too, right? Like, it's not enough for me to just have an experience and then I live off of that. We talk about that, and we probably all know that from our personal experiences. I mean, I had a white light experience and that was amazing and I was on fire, and talk to me 2 months later, I was really selfish again. I need an ongoing experience with this stuff. But, so the third step today is a really different conscious step. Of when I see I've got my claw marks in this, like the boyfriend's got to go or this girl's not going to be okay. Like, I, you know, my sponsor says, you willing to put this one in prayer and ask what it is in you that's keeping you sick over her? Ask what is in you that thinks that you can keep her in check. You know, there are certain things as a quasi-parent, I don't know what I am, but that I'm responsible for, but there are plenty of things that God's responsible for. And that third step today gets to be, I consciously bite my tongue. Sometimes that's what it looks like, right? I can bite my tongue instead of trying to take control. I get to pray and really ask for help for me and not for her. And I would love like another half hour, but I'll do what I can here. The fourth step for me was not a really terrifying experience. I don't know why. I think it was because I was delusional enough to think, again, like, you guys were really sick and this is not going to be a problem. And I like talking about myself a lot. So I was like, okay with writing this stuff down. This is true. I was just not so scared about this. But I did hit the sex part of the inventory and it was like, I had blown through that thing. And then this portion of my life, which I had worn like a shield of armor. This was a space. I look back today, and I know that a lot of my relationship with sex conduct had to do with abuse that I had at the hand of my brother's friend when I was 11, and that formed a lot of what I decided about myself as a woman and what sex conduct was and wasn't. And I, again, none of this stuff. This wasn't revealed in my fourth step. Like, I touched on this a little bit. You know, somewhere six years down the line, I started to look at some of this stuff. It's amazing. When I was younger in sobriety, and I would hear people say time takes time, or like you just hear people with longer periods of time, and you know, my pride was getting in the way, thinking, what does that matter? Which I think is why I still don't remember my sobriety date, because I made it such a conscious effort not to care about time. But I see now, like, the experience that, say, Meister has at 16, or I think she has more than that year sober, she's experienced so much more than I have, and in such a beautiful way that when I come to her, it's like, it's not, you know, I'm up in a panic, and she just has had that delusion taken from her already. No idea what I was saying. Oh, that I hit the brakes on that part of my fourth step, and I started to realize, although I had come in here and thought, like, what's the big deal? Why are you guys complaining about this fourth step? I don't mind telling you all about what's going on with me. And then I hit this piece of myself that I had been in delusion about, that I thought for sure this was no big deal, and I treated sex like it was just some other thing. It was something I used just like alcohol, right? I did not know how to love myself, so if I needed to use my body to get a little bit of love from you, that was fine. That was fine. It was just the cost of doing business kind of thing. The same way that alcohol, like the consequences, they were just the cost of doing business. Because I needed to feel okay. It was back to that selfishness, and it didn't matter who I hurt. It didn't matter who I scared in my family, the way I, you know, reckless abandon, and they didn't know who I was with or where I was and any of that stuff. And I got to that sex conduct and I realized, holy crap, I actually do care about this and there's something under this, and I got pushed by a loving sponsor to keep moving through that. And boy, the fourth step, the fifth step uncovers that stuff. All the ways I came in here and I thought it's just alcohol, drugs too. Yeah, come on, that'll be a problem for anybody, right? That was like how I was thinking, and got to the fourth step. And I distinctly remember sitting in my room working on the fourth step, and I was in the base of my parents' house where they had let me come back, and writing out a resentment against my mother, who I had not had a relationship with. Like I said, we couldn't be in the same room together for years. And writing out this resentment at her about something. It was like she never taught me how to put on makeup. She's like a bra-burning feminist, so she doesn't do makeup. And it was, the resentment was like everybody else knows how to put on makeup, and everybody else's mother taught them how to put on makeup. And the profound experience that I had there, it was like, I think it was like the first time I really felt human in sobriety, because I'd had this tough guy shield up. I mean, that's the kind of girl I was when I walked in here. I was probably like most of you girls, like, I just don't get along with girls. it's men, I relate more to them. Yeah, like we all have that experience. And it has to do more with what I said earlier than anything else. But I had this moment where that tough exterior cracked and I felt the tears start running down my eyes, because the reality was I wasn't pissed about the makeup. And the reality was is that not every other woman in the world, mother, had taught them how to put on makeup the way I thought that they had, and that had therefore somehow made them some complete... Well, I don't know what the story was, but I know that the fourth step cracked me in that moment. I knew that what was really going on was that I was terribly afraid and scared that my mom didn't really love me. Which really meant I was terribly afraid and scared that I wasn't worth loving. Right? And this was something as simple as makeup, right? And we come in here with our experiences with people where people treat us all sorts of ways. And I've learned the common theme in here from plenty of, talking to plenty of you guys and my own experiences. I have a filter. My alcoholic mind makes that all about me. The truth was, like, my mom doesn't believe in makeup. When I wear high heels, she's like, oh, man, they suckered you in. She loves the crap out of me. You know, and the fourth step started to crack this stuff down. And when I got to the fifth step, it was more of the same, because I saw plenty. But in the fifth step, my sponsor pushed me so hard to take that wall of self-loathing down. Because I had started to see pretty quickly in the fourth step that it wasn't about you guys anymore. I couldn't deny it. This is constant. It was like I wrote this huge fourth step of all these dishonesties, what I think it meant, right? Which included things like every other woman has a deep and loving relationship with their mother where they learned how to put on makeup, which completed their life. Like that's, it was like a whole book of these stories. And I started to see pretty quickly, okay, it's not them. But in the fifth step, I was still carrying a lot of, but it's me. And with her Me Toos and her loving and gentle experience with her own higher power, that stuff started to crumble. And six and seven, the same thing. Six and seven at that time, I just didn't understand the power of them. I mean, I did them and I prayed those prayers and I begged for willingness and I asked that any of that stuff be removed. But I see today, like when this stuff comes up, I mean, if you want to know what should go on your six and seven step, like just get in a relationship. Or marriage. Can't even think of running anymore, right? Like I have to ask what's mine that gets to go, so that I can be of service to you. Because when I'm in service to you, this is the catch. I thought if I'm in service to me, I get what I need. When I'm in service to me, all hell breaks loose. When I'm in service to you, I get what I need. And six and seven are so different today. And I'm probably going to steal a couple minutes of your time just so I can round this out. But the eighth and ninth step, sometimes I think when I was younger in sobriety, I was like, I wish I had a rougher background. I could have these really tough amends, because I didn't have a lot of tough amends. I had amends where I sat down with people and they said, oh, you didn't notice that. Because I was this really isolated alcoholic. But there were some that struck me right between the eyes, right? Like friends that I sat with who would say just as simply as, like, we just didn't know what was wrong. And we were just so scared for you. I hadn't done a lot of the rob and cheat and steal and stuff, but in the material sense, right? We all have had experience with emotionally robbing people blind and being so unconscious of those effects. And when we're in it, saying, what? Like, why do you even care? This is about me. And the fourth and fifth step showed me all those people that were affected. And I'll just say that the experience, I mean, the power of the amends, like, I'll give you a quick story. I was with my husband, I don't know where we were traveling, and he was driving, and we were about to maybe go through a toll lane, or about the highway was about to split. And I said, go to the left. And he was really not going to the left, which meant we were about to get off this highway. And I'm like, would you just go to the left? Like, I'm flipping out. and he then screams back at me. And then we're sitting in silence for I don't know how long. And in my head, like, I know enough to know I have just bypassed the principles. And there was really no need for that, right? And so I'm like, just say sorry. And then I hear, like, no, not gonna say sorry. So if it is this hard for me to apologize for the fact that I just flipped out because you can't go to the left lane, like, there's something holding me back, right? It's Mr. Ego. It is that thing that says it will protect me no matter what. You need to keep me alive no matter what. And it's the one thing that stands in the way of me knowing me and me knowing you and me trusting that fundamentally things are okay. So if the ego is quaking in its boots over saying I'm sorry because I just yelled at my husband over a traffic lane, can you imagine how humbling and how powerful these real amends are over things that we've carried, shame that we've carried for decades? You know, and that's where the promises unfold themselves in there, is because when the ego can't survive, when the ego can't survive, our spiritual selves arise, right? Just naturally. And that's one of the beautiful things about this program, is I thought I had to plan it out and work it so hard and like figure out how to become this person. And I love when I hear speakers say it's really an unbuilding, right? It's like it's a dismantling of the ego. I don't have to figure out how to build Rachel up. I need to figure out how to move what gets in the way. And so all of those beautiful experiences, the what I hear called the maintenance steps, 10, 11, and 12, the spot check inventory for me is so amazingly powerful. And the truth is I don't do it today as much as I used to, but when I do it, I'm like, holy crap. It's again the power of the me too right there in the moment when I'm like sure it's all your fault, or I'm sure I'm not going to be okay, and I get to pick up the phone before it then becomes another fourth step. And when I do that, then my 11th step becomes really different, right? Because if I am not reaching out to somebody or getting clear on what's my part in the moment when things feel really awful, when I go to sit in silence, that's all I hear. All I hear is, it's not okay. It's not okay. Why are they telling me it's okay? It's not going to be okay. You should have done this and they didn't do that. And so when I'm grounded in spot check inventories, my 11th step experience is really different. And I have found that the book and this fellowship gives us a lot of guidance about what that looks like to seek a relationship with a higher power and to carry out whatever that looks like. But I love how personal I have realized how personal this truly is for me. I never feel closer to God than when I'm like flying down the highway with my windows open and the music blaring. It's just true. And whatever that experience looks like for any of us, you know, that's our commitment to our 11th step, because I thought it had to look a certain way, and for about 3 years that held me back from sitting in any kind of meditation at all. And I realized today that it, for all of us, we're so very different people that our experience with connecting with our higher power can look different. And the only way to keep any of this stuff alive, only way is the 12th step. And I can't tell you, and I'm sure plenty of you have this experience, how many times it's like I'll have myself committed to doing some 12 step work and I'm like, I can't believe I have to go out and do this. And then I come back home like bebopping in the house. Like, life is good. I have been removed from me. Like, thank God for 12-step work. And the other piece, of course, is that these women who come into my life, or anybody who comes into my life in that capacity, has so much to teach me. And I didn't always see it that way. And now that my eyes are open to know that every time a woman walks into my life, the reality is they're about to show me my work. It is a whole new experience. So I appreciate you guys letting me go over a little bit, and thank you so much for having me up here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.